One of the newest objects on display at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art is a sculpture from the Congo. A little bald guy made out of wood and metal stands about 2 feet tall. He smiles broadly, even as nails stick into his shredded leather torso. This is an Nkisi object created not for display in a museum in Kansas City, but for spiritual and medicinal purposes in another part of the globe. But the power of objects like these can be felt in unexpected places and unexpected ways. American artist Renee Stout joins us this morning to tell us the story of how one of these objects changed her life. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And Renee Stout, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
When did you first see an Nkisi object?
Well, when I was about 10 years old, I was being taken to Saturday art classes at the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh. And in the natural history section of the museum, they had an Nkisi and Condi. Now, I didn't know exactly what that was at the time. All I know is that as a child, I was drawn to the object. And every time my father would take me to the museum on Saturday morning, I would stop by and see that along with the mummies.
Wait, can you describe it?
Well, actually, there are a variety of these things. And most of the time, the general Nkisi and Condi is a figure, like a human figure. And like you said, usually about, a couple of feet tall. Sometimes they're smaller, sometimes they're larger. But they're carved out of wood and have human-like features. But there are nails sticking in the figure. I mean, there could be like hundreds and hundreds of nails coming out of the figure, and one of their arms is usually raised. And sometimes when you see these figures, the hand might not have a spear in it or a club, and then sometimes it does, because sometimes they've been removed.
So you would stop by and see those every Saturday?
Yes.
Why?
Well, it's because I was fascinated and I didn't know why. And, because like I said, being 10 years old, that wasn't something that I had ever been exposed to before, except in the museum. And like I said, it was in the natural history part of the museum and not in the art part of the museum, where we would eventually end up as a group of students from, a variety of schools in the Pittsburgh public school system, who were all talented in the arts, like we could all draw. And so art teachers from all over the country recommended particular students for these Saturday art classes, and they would come from all over the city and to meet at the Carnegie Museum, and we would be instructed by a man named Joseph Fitzpatrick, who was a retired Pittsburgh public school art teacher and had actually been my father's art teacher growing up. And so Mr. Fitzpatrick would lead these classes of students, and talk about art. And then we would draw in this big auditorium. And later he would take us to the natural history part of the museum where we would draw from some of the, objects in the cases.
Does it seem strange to you now that these were displayed as natural history and not as art?
It's interesting because an object like that doesn't quite fit into any categories that the Western art canon would set up for it, because basically in the culture that it was created, it was meant to be a ritual object. But at the same time, because there was great care taken into, how it was created, it can also fall into the form of like an art, an aesthetic object, an art object. So back then, like I said, it was displayed in the ethnographic section of the museum. But then later on, years later, after I went back to the Carnegie Museum, it's now in a vitrine of its own in the art section of the Carnegie Museum.
Well, I want to talk to you about that more, but I'm still very curious about the power that this kind of object had on you before you even really knew what it was when you were pretty young. I mean,
go ahead.
Well, I could imagine being a kid and seeing a figure with nails sticking mm-hmm. into its torso being kind of scary.
Well, guess what? It was, scary. And in some ways, it was kind of and maybe that's why I was fascinated by it. I mean, I grew up on watching chiller theater. And, so maybe that's why I was drawn to it. I always liked horror movies as well as a child. But that's not quite the way it struck me. I wasn't fearful of it. I was just fascinated by the idea of a figure having all these nails stuck in it and not knowing why. you know. So, but I, it was interesting because I remember as we were being led into the natural history part of the museum, and we had stopped, you know, we were in a long line, and we were kind of stopped in front of the case, and one of the boys in the back said, you know, who was kind of like in back of me, said, "Oh, look at that voodoo doll." And it's like, I didn't even know anything about voodoo back then. So I'm just like, you know, what does he mean by that? And what is this object? So there were all these, always these questions in the back of my mind about the piece, but visually I was attracted to it. And so it wasn't until later on, you know, after going to college and that kind of thing, when I left Pittsburgh and moved to Washington, D.C., where I would discover more about it. Because at that time, in the Carnegie Museum, they didn't have extensive information about that piece. And when I read the little identification card next to it, it just said fetish, Congo. That's all the information that they had. So it's not like I, you know, understood the purpose of it at that point or anything like that. Like I said, later on, when I moved to Washington, D.C. and discovered the Smithsonian's National Museum of African Art, you know, that's when I would learn so much more about an object like that.
So at this point, when you're seeing it at the Smithsonian and you're older, I mean, tell me about how your art career has progressed at that point, and then we'll go on that journey with you too. But what were you doing? What were you making at that point in your career?
Okay, at that point, okay, I went to Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh. And now, when I was taking the Saturday art classes, I was in grade school and then junior high school because I went to the Saturday art classes for about 5 years. And so when I finally went to college and decided that I was going to major in art, I majored in painting. And so at the same time that I had discovered it in Kesey at the museum, the art teacher, the fourth grade art teacher, had given out these art history books that were written for our level. And one of the first things I saw was a painting by the American painter Edward Hopper, and it was called Nighthawks. And it's a famous, iconic painting of Edward Hopper. And most Americans may recognize it as, it's a really dark painting of a street at night, and there's a diner. And in the diner, there's a man that's working, you know, he has this, you know, white hat and white coat on, and he's getting coffee for three people who are sitting at a counter. And I don't know if you've seen it yourself, but most people are familiar with that painting. Well, that was Edward Hopper. And there was something about that painting that had such a sense of mystery to me. I was drawn to that. And so I decided that I wanted to be a painter. And some of my early paintings were kind of in the style, the realistic style of Edward Hopper. And, you know, I would go out in Pittsburgh and paint street scenes. You know, I'd go downtown and I would take my camera because a very shy person, I didn't want to, you know, paint outside while people were watching me. So I would take photographs of scenes that I wanted to paint and go back home. And, you know, so a lot of my early paintings were realistic paintings in the manner of Edward Hopper. So that's the way I painted all up until I would graduate from Carnegie Mellon in, say, about 1980. And at that time, not only was I still, you know, being influenced by Edward Hopper, but also the photorealists. There were photorealistic painters that they painted like they were painting photographs. And that's what their paintings end up looking like. And I was, you know, striving to be that technically, you know, good at doing something like that. So there was Richard Estes and Ralph Goings and people like that, that people can look up and see what their work looked like to understand what I'm talking about. But so when I graduated from Carnegie Mellon, I was totally focused on painting, and that in Kesey and Condi was like just in the back of my mind. That is until I moved to Washington, D.C. 5 years later after graduating from Carnegie Mellon in 1985.
And so you see again an in Kesey object, and this time with more information.
Definitely. It's like the Museum of African Art in, you know, the Smithsonian's Museum is the most wonderful museum in that, you know, they take great pride in giving you a background on these objects. So when I first moved to Washington, D.C. and realized that all of the museums in the Smithsonian are free to the public at all times, you know, I would go to museums every Saturday. I would just, you know, go out and pick a museum to go to. I might go to several. Because you could just go in and out. You didn't have to pay. And so one of my favorite museums became the Museum of African Art. And they had so many different forms of African art from all of the different countries in Africa. So that whole world opened up. But that main Nkisi still stuck with me, so that when I encountered other objects like this in the museum, I really wanted to study more about them. And I eventually started, you know, reading more about them. Although, you know, I can never say that I'll ever be an expert on anything like that, because it's just, you know, the idea behind that, the concepts behind it, the history behind those pieces are just too extensive for somebody like me who's an artist. You know, I'm focusing on my art. But in the, you know, the process of researching these things and being influenced by them in my work, I've met many people who are, you know, authorities on these objects and the cultures that they come from, and have told me information about them that has, you know, helped to enrich my view of them and, you know, my appreciation of them.
What are some of the things that you now understand about the role of the Nkisi that has inspired you? Can you tell us, I mean, you were in this place where you had been intrigued but not known very much, and then little pieces of information seemed to get you started down a totally different path. Can you share some of those pieces of information, some of the basics about the Nkisi and its role in this culture in the Congo?
Yeah, you know, as an African American child, okay, when I was growing up, you know, we were being called black. And then there was a time, okay, then all of a sudden it was African American. So by the time that I moved to Washington, D.C., you were using the term African American. And what does that mean to be African American? You know, I'm totally immersed in an American culture. You know, I was raised in this culture. My parents were raised in this culture. My grandparents were raised in this culture. So I'm American. But what does that African part mean? So when I got out on my own and I'm studying, you know, looking at the African art and going to the museum and returning again and again, I really started to want to know, you know, about the culture that these pieces came from. And so when I started studying that, you know, it occurred to me that, you know, we live in a, you know, a country that claims to be open to all religions and celebrates the fact that people have different religions. Yet when you really get down to it, there's a sort of push to decide that this is going to be a Christian nation. And in studying these African, you know, objects, I realized that my ancestors, who were part African, because, you know, I have, you know, a lot of ancestry. I just did one of those Ancestry.com things where I found out, I'm of many cultures, but primarily I have African blood. So that's what I wanted to focus on. And these cultures have their own religions and their own, you know, philosophies of how the universe came to be. And so that opened my mind. And I really wanted to sort of connect to the spiritual, you know, concepts that some of my ancestors may have had. And I think what made it easy to do that and not feel any fear or guilt about that is when I was growing up, one of my grandmothers was Baptist and one was Catholic. My mother and father didn't go to church, but they let us go to church with either one of the grandmothers we wanted to go to church with. So when I got a little bit older, like 20 something, I, you know, I asked my father, I'm like, you know, you never forced me, and I have a sister, one sister, I said, you never forced us to go to church. Why is that? And he said, because we feel like religion is a very personal thing, and we didn't want to force anything on you. We wanted you to make your own decisions when you got older. And so, you know, I grew up with this open mind about religion. So it really allowed me to be open to the things that I would discover about them in Nkisi.
How are they supposed to work? What is the idea behind those details, like the nails, for example?
Well, the general idea, and like I'm going to give a simplistic view, because like I said, these things are so complex. There's no way that in one radio, you know.
Right. We won't become experts. I can,
yeah, we won't. So the general idea is that in African communities, there is a structure, there is an order to society, just like any society, like ours, like anybody's, anywhere in the world. And these objects are religious and spiritual and ritualistic objects that help people to deal with any circumstances that they were in, would encounter, you know, on a daily basis. Now, one way of an Nkisi can be used, because Minkisi is plural, Nkisi is singular. But one way an Nkisi can be used is, let's say somebody is facing some situation that they really have, you know, a problem, they can't resolve it on their own. So they would go to a spiritual person called an Nganga, who is the person that would be in charge of keeping these Nkisi, Minkisi, in a certain place. They would sit down and have a consultation with the Nganga. They would, you know, lay out their problem. A discussion would take place. Okay, then the Nganga would give them a nail. They would say what they need. They would put the nail to their lips, and the saliva would touch the nail, and then the nail would be driven in to the Nkisi. And the Nkisi is basically a vessel that would house the spirits of the ancestors. So they would be calling on their ancestors to help them resolve this problem. So once the nail is driven in, it would activate the action of the ancestors to help the person resolve their problem.
So your art started taking on a really different direction. I mean, you'd been working on these very, like, photorealistic style paintings, and you moved on to a whole different kind of deal. Can you describe what you started working on after that trip to the Smithsonian?
Yeah, you know, I was painting sort of simultaneously in that same style. But what started to happen is, at the time I was working at, you know, when I first moved to D.C., I wasn't an independent artist. I still had a day job, and I was working at a local Montessori school. And sometimes, you know, when they would get rid of old toys that were, you know, broken or whatever, I would collect them and take them home, like dolls, for example. And I found that what I was starting to do is to wrap these dolls and start to adorn them in the same way that I'd seen them adorned in the museum, the way the Nkisi were set up. So I was doing a series of these pieces that were inspired by the Nkisi, but yet I was calling them fetishes, the same way I had seen them called when I was growing up in Pittsburgh. But then after studying more, I realized, you know, and in speaking with, you know, people who had studied these objects extensively, that was an incorrect term. That had been a term that was assigned to these pieces by the first colonists that had come to Africa and encountered these pieces. They called them fetishes. That's not what they were supposed to be called. They were Nkisi, and they are also known as power objects. So my first few pieces were called fetishes, incorrectly, but that's what they were called. And then eventually I started moving on from those works, but all the work that I do now is still influenced by those, you know, the basic ideas and concepts of the Nkisi.
Yeah, I had interpreted that as a series called Fetish, and it is really very clearly in conversation with these Congolese sculptures. And you use materials like cowrie shells, beads, coins, and even monkey hair, really stuff you do not get at the art supply store.
Right. Because, you know, I realized in looking at these things, they were gathering objects from nature, you know, organic things like seeds and things like that, you know, adorned a lot of these things. And so I started incorporating that into my art as well. So along with the acrylic paint that I was buying from the art store, in certain materials like that, beads that you can get from the art store, I was also incorporating things from nature that I would find on the street, you know, maybe a metal bottle cap or something like that. That's probably one of the reasons why I was so fascinated by seeing the Nkisi as a child. It was a mixed media object. It wasn't just a painting. It incorporated all kinds of materials.
Talking about the spiritual use of these objects and that it's sort of a way to appeal to ancestors for help with your life. I mean, did you treat the objects you were creating that way at all, even in some loose sense?
I really did, because at some point in time, you know, when I broke away from the painting, and I have to mention, I became so fascinated with working, you know, three-dimensionally and being able to use a variety of media and materials that I became disinterested in painting for, it would be like years before I'd paint again after I started doing the three-dimensional objects. And when I was using these objects, because I realized what the original and Kesey were used for, there was a shift in my mind where my art, you know, stopped being sort of a separate thing that I was doing. Like I would create the art. Okay, here's a pretty picture, you know, of a street scene. You know, I became really kind of attached to the art in a kind of way where it's like it became a therapeutic activity to do the work, and also an act of reverence for the guidance of the ancestors, which I increasingly started to feel as I was working on these pieces. There was the idea that the ancestors had led me there.
Can you explain that a little more? I mean, you had talked about just the process of even discovering that there had been this part of yourself that was, in some historical sense, African. That part of the term African American coming into use had been the beginning of that kind of self-realization for you. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So these ancestors, I'm guessing, are people whose personal stories you didn't necessarily know. I mean, you're appealing to, in some way, unknown ancestors. Talk to mm-hmm. me about how that worked.
You know, it worked in a strange way. I just opened my mind, and I felt that whenever I was in my studio, I never felt alone. And I had this feeling that there were people watching over me. I didn't see faces or anything like that. I just felt like I was being taken care of, and I wasn't alone, and that in some way somebody is saying, if you need us, call on us. I don't know why I had that feeling.
Well, when we return, we will continue this discussion with Renee Stout, and we'll talk with someone from the Nelson Atkins to hear more about the Nkisi they've added to their collection. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we've been talking to artist Renee Stout in Washington, D.C. about how her career as an artist has been inspired by a kind of spiritual and medicinal object from the Congo called Nkisi. There's a new one at the Nelson, new in the sense that the Nelson now has it, and now we're going to hear about that from Rachel Kabukala. She's with us from the museum's Department of African Art. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, how are you, Gina?
Good. What is it like for you to hear this personal story about how someone else connected with one of these objects as someone who's been working with one professionally?
It's fascinating, and I love hearing Renee talk about these figures and how they affected her personally. And my hope is that it can have that type of an impact on one of our visitors.
Tell me about the Nkisi in the Nelson's collection.
So the object that we recently acquired is an Nkisi Nkondi from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and it is a really fascinating type of Nkisi Nkondi. It's a little bit different.
And when you say Nkisi Nkondi, can you explain that? I've been using a very general term, Nkisi, and that's because I am so far from being an expert that I just would rather leave it to you.
Well, and I too hope to be an expert one day. But when you say Nkisi Nkondi, it is referring to the specific type of Nkisi that Renee saw when she was young. So it is that, as she described, that often figurative, it looks like it represents an ancestor, so it looks like a human figure with the pieces of metal embedded into it. So it's when people hear power figure or that antiquated term fetish, it's probably what they're envisioning.
So this was acquired in 2016, pretty new. Does the Nelson have other sculptures like it, or is this the first Nkisi Nkondi or the first Nkisi in the collection?
So we have a handful of Nkisi in our African collection, but again, they're so different that they're sort of unrecognizable as Minkisi. This is the first Nkisi Nkondi, which again, that is kind of the... because of the ways in which that they have been represented in recent exhibitions, that's kind of the gold standard for Nkisi. So it's really exciting to have an Nkisi Nkondi now in the African collection. And I feel like it in some ways really rounds out the collection that we have.
What's your personal relationship with the part of the world where these are made, the Congo?
So when I was in college, I was able to travel to the Congo and stayed for several weeks in the southern region of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so I was really intrigued with the country and the people and the culture. And my husband is actually from the southern part of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so he, you know, takes great pleasure in coming into the gallery and seeing objects that remind him of his home and his culture. It's a really wonderful thing.
Does your husband respond differently to this object or objects like this than you do or Renee does?
You know, I have heard him talk about the objects in a similar way that Renee and I were conversing about the objects recently. He talked about specifically, we have some Kifwebe masks in the gallery that are also used, as Renee said, you know, they're a part of a society and there's a societal structure. And these objects in some ways were used to kind of keep everyone in their place. And so he has talked about how seeing those masks reminded him that as a child, there was this, it was intriguing, but yet you were a little bit fearful. And that's what they were designed to do. They were designed to be used in the societies to you know, as objects.
What do you mean when you say they kept people in their place or keep people in their place? I'm
Renee, do you remember when we were talking about this?
Yes. And you know what? Okay, let's. I have the perfect answer for that.
Thank you.
You know how, because we live in a Christian society, the term the fear of God is often used.
Like it put the fear of God in me.
To put the fear of God in you. Well, that's what these things do. It's the same thing.
So would you say that he has a sense of fearfulness in response to these, or that's just something he remembers people having?
Well, certainly he talks specifically about an experience he had as a child and viewing these masks being used in a ritual, you know, display. And as a child, he was able to recognize that you know, these objects were designed to instill a little bit of fear or trepidation. So.
Well, I'd like both of you to talk to me a little bit about these objects that were intended for a very specific kind of personal and spiritual purpose in the context of a culture on the other side of the globe. What does it do to them or to their role to display them in a museum in the middle of the United States of America? I'll start with you, Renee.
You know, some people, you know, they say that because the object has been removed from its original culture and its original purpose, it renders them powerless. You know, it's you need it to be, you know, you need the whole sort of thing going on for the objects to maintain their power. And that may be true on some level. But then again, if you take a case like my case, where I see the object and it activates something in me, then I don't see it as powerless. It had some power over me. So, you know, it's like I kind of see it in a different way because it took on a different power in the context that I saw it in, you know, and I related to it and it made me want to know more. So in a sense, the object pulled me back to some place where my ancestors was. So, you know, where they were. And so it had its own kind of power in its new setting for me.
Rachel, yeah, what are your thoughts about this as someone who's maybe in more of a museum-y kind of conversation in your daily life?
Yeah, well, I feel that it's really important that we're able to display these objects in the museum because it promotes the idea that these are on par with all of the other types of art that we see within the institution. And so they are certainly powerful objects that were created for a purpose, but they are aesthetically beautiful and were crafted by master artists. And to not downplay the relevance of the continent and the art that it produces and has produced.
You're working with this object in the context of a Picasso exhibit. Do I understand that right?
Yes.
Tell me about, that's a whole other context for viewing African art, African spiritual objects, I mean, both in one.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be a fantastic exhibition, not without its challenges because, you know, historically, as Renee had mentioned, these objects were, you know, titled incorrectly and the perceptions of what they were and how they were used or even if people were considering how they had been used weren't always accurate. And so it's navigating that history, but also being able to present the material in a different way for viewers to maybe change their perception.
But how do objects like this one, African objects, in this case in Kisi, what do they have to do with this Picasso exhibit? Tell me about that.
So artists like Picasso in his day, he was a revolutionary. And part of what he did that was different from what other artists of the time were doing, or what most other artists were doing, was he lived with African objects and objects from Oceania, and he found them fascinating, probably, and I can't speak for Renee, but I would assume in some of the same ways. You know, he saw these things and
exactly.
They gripped him, and he didn't quite know why, but he was intrigued. and yeah, maybe Renee can speak more to that, but
I agree. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It sounds, you know, he probably looked at them in the same way I did. I mean, you look at something like that and it's like, oh my God, what is that? It's strange, but I'm attracted to it.
You know, Renee, that brings up something that intrigued me about your story, is that it seems like not having information also is part of what held power over you. I mean, these objects affected you in a different way once you knew. But had you just had the answer as a child, do you think that you would have carried this curiosity and desire to keep going back in that same way?
That's an interesting question, because, you know, one of the things that I like to have my own work to have is a sense of mystery for the viewer. Like, I want to give them some information, but I don't want to give them all the information. I want the objects or the paintings that I create to also evoke a sense of mystery to draw them in so that it sticks with them. And I think that that's the way this object worked for me. And I think the idea that I didn't know everything about it is what kept me coming back to it.
Do you think, how do you feel about, I don't know, people learning and understanding? That seems like important. That's an important lesson from your story, just that people called this a fetish when that's really not a very, I don't know, not quite the right word, not quite understanding
right.
It and maybe stereotyping quite a bit. But then at the same time, not knowing was profound. I mean, you could just respond to it on a gut level.
And that's exactly what I did. And I think that's exactly why, you know, it really opened up my mind, because as an artist, I just responded to an object, you know, just from my gut and, you know, not having any imposed, you know, ideas about it, you know, being imposed on me. I was just free to basically look at the object and allow it to inspire me.
Do you still visit Minakisi for inspiration?
Any chance I get.
What is one that you've seen recently that really gripped you? Can you describe it for us and tell us about it?
I can describe one, but I don't know his exact name. And I think he's in a collection in Belgium. Rachel will know who he is. And I was in a show recently called Congo Across the Waters that traveled to a few cities in the U.S. And this was like a couple of years ago. And I'm not sure if he was in the show that I was in that the Smithsonian did back in 93, but I have seen him in several books, but I actually saw him in Congo Across the Waters again and actually saw him. And I refer to him as my boyfriend because he's just the most amazing in Kisi that I've ever seen. Rachel, do you know the one I'm talking about? He might be about 5 feet tall.
I think I do.
Yeah, he might be like 4 or 5 feet tall, with all kinds of stuff on him, nails, he's just so encrusted with things. And he is standing with arms akimbo in that position where his hands are on his hips.
Yeah, elbows out.
Elbows out, leaning forward.
What do you love about this guy? Your boyfriend.
Because, you know... Yeah, he's my boyfriend. It's like, because they're so powerful, you know, it's like even the small ones that you see to me have a sense of power. But this one is just, it's first of all, the fact that the size that it is and, you know, the way it was carved, it's just a masterpiece.
Well, Rachel, Renee, thank you both so much for talking to me today about Minakisi in general and the one at the Nelson in particular.
Thanks, Gina.
Thank you. Thank you, Gina.
Up next, another object's power is a little more questionable. It's a boat made out of cardboard. Why an artist spent 2 years making it and what happened when he put it on the water. Stay tuned. We're back now with an artist who set sail in a cardboard boat. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Steve Snell, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
I realized getting ready for this show that you could have a really cool, like, what do you call him, tongue twister? Steve Snell set sail.
Yeah, the alliteration.
Yeah, just in case you ever want to be a tongue twister. So, spoiler alert, I guess your ship didn't sink because you were here?
No, it actually floated great. I was really pleased with the balance, which was one of two major things I was concerned about was, well, how tippy is it going to be? During my first test last fall, that was a huge issue. The slightest breeze would basically flip me over. But I solved that problem. The second issue to deal with was how to control it and how to steer it. And that was a bit more problematic.
Yeah. How do you steer a cardboard boat?
Well, you make a cardboard rudder, which is one of the things I was most proud of with that boat. It was basically like a door hinge, and I could turn my rudder to, hopefully point me in the right direction. But
here's what I'm struggling with imagining that. And I am not an engineer or boat builder. I mean, I'm like really far from those things. So forgive me if this is insane, but I mean, the power of a river current compared to the power of a cardboard thing moving against it, that seems like not a good match. And so I'm having trouble understanding how this cardboard rudder is effective.
Well, that's a great question because it wasn't very effective. And that was probably one of the things that I think it would have been more effective if the wind wasn't blowing over 20 miles an hour. I don't think a rudder is going to do much in that case anyway. But
any rudder?
It might help a little bit with the force of that river and the wind blowing at that speed. Really paddling is the way that you're going to probably point yourself in the right direction.
Yeah, and you went out on Saturday. It was a windy weekend for Kansas City.
It was, but I successfully landed at Kaw Point and just crossed the threshold of the confluence into the Missouri River, but I couldn't have really done it without the help of some amazing friends in a canoe and the Healthy Rivers Partnership people in their boat to kind of hold me in place and make sure I don't float out uncontrollably downriver.
Well, we're going to get back to the journey over the weekend, but you built this boat out of cardboard over the course of 2 years, and you modeled it after the boat Lewis and Clark used navigating this very spot at the confluence of the Kansas and Missouri Rivers. Why did you do this? This is a very labor-intensive project.
Well, I guess the simplest answer is because it sounded like fun. And I started it 2 summers ago. I just moved to Kansas City in the fall of 2015. And the summer before moving down here, I was living up in Nebraska City. And, I saw the Missouri River, and I saw Lewis and Clark Museum, and this idea just kind of popped into my head that I want to build a boat and go down that river. And I'm going to make it out of cardboard, because I've always wanted to do that.
So you've always just separately wanted to make a boat out of cardboard?
Well, I know people do that, and I just had never had the opportunity. And
what people do that?
Oh, there's cardboard boat races all over the country. Sometimes it's a class project in like engineering or in art classes, art 3D design. And so I just thought like, well, this is an opportunity that I can do, and it'd be a fun experience to go down the Missouri River. I had spent the previous 3 years living up on the Nebraska prairie and was far from a river. And so just the presence of seeing that water, I mean, it got me excited. It made me want to take advantage of living on a river. And just turned out that it was a much more daunting and time intensive and labor intensive and dangerous proposal than I first realized it was.
So you just had the idea and you didn't overthink it. And then the details made themselves clear as you went along.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it really developed and evolved over 2 years. I mean, it was kind of like an excuse to get something started, but that led to a lot of research and a lot of art making and, you know, produced an art show out of it that this project that went down the river was kind of the culmination for me of a 2 year art project that I was fortunate enough to be included at the Charlotte Street La Esquina Gallery prior to taking it downriver.
So what were some of the unexpected challenges or just surprises in actually building a cardboard boat intended to be successful on rivers?
Well, I guess one of the major challenges is that it's just cardboard, it's paper. So, I mean, I coated this, I should tell everyone, with a marine epoxy resin. I built it not just as a sculptural object, but as a boat that could hopefully withstand the Missouri River.
So if you try this at home, you don't just put paper on water and expect that to go well?
Well, don't expect it to go well for too long. you'll hold up for a little bit, but I wanted my boat to last. And I really wanted it. My original dream was to go all the way from Nebraska City to Kansas City. That's 200 miles. It's about a 7-day trip. That would have been a terrible idea to try in the cardboard boat, because all it takes is, you know, a sharp rock or something to punch a hole through the resin and break the cardboard.
Was it important to you not just yourself be safe in this trip, but also to keep the boat safe? Because I imagine that would be a kind of hard thing about what you're talking about, to spend 2 years building something and then taken on an adventure that, of course, is the culmination of what you've been working toward, but also could destroy it.
And it did destroy it in bits, but I'm okay with that. I can fix it. It's just paper. But that was, I try not to be too precious about it as an object. I mean, it is precious in the sense that I've labored two summers, pretty much full time. I teach, so I had all that time in the summer to work on my boat. And, you know, I had the opportunity to show it, and now it made sense that I had to take it on the river, and whatever happens, happens. And, you know, it did take on some water. I did have a little hole poked through it right there at the end of the trip, but I can fix it, and I will.
So you followed the model for the boat that Lewis and Clark used. What were some things about working with that boat design that intrigued you as someone now building its replica out of a different, very different material and at a very different scale?
Very different scale. The scale of the boat is about 12 feet long. It's just big enough for one person. I had hoped to.
And you're not like all the way inside it either. I mean, it's not like a boat that you're, I mean, it's a pretty small boat.
It's a small boat. It's like a kayak size, I'd say. I mean, I can fit in it completely, and it has cargo space, and it even has an articulating cannon and a sail. But I guess what intrigued me about their design was really just based on like the relevance of the history of the area that, you know, they had come up through here, and kind of playing in that American myth and that story and that image, that I could just kind of use that as a starting point for my own story, for my own myth that I might want to create. But also I found like it just to be an interesting challenge. There is no, from as far as I know, and maybe a historian knows better, but there is no like exact replica of Lewis and Clark's keelboat. There is like a little doodle sketch that is in Meriwether's journal. And most replicas are just based off of that. But their actual boat was sold for scrap, I think, down in St. Louis a decade or so after they landed.
So tell me about the day that you took the boat out, what that felt like to you, you know, waking up that morning and looking at your boat and being like, today's the day.
Oh, to be honest, I was nervous. There is a lot of unknowns, and you know, I call this work adventure art in the sense that it needs to be a real adventure, and there has to be an unknown element, and you need to risk failing. And that was a total possibility. I didn't know how well it was going to balance. I had created these outrigger-like oars to hopefully solve that problem, which they did, and I'm really, really happy about that. But then the other unknown was, how well is it going to steer? I have a lot of respect for these rivers, both the Kansas and the Missouri River. And, you know, while I'm willing to take risks in terms of failure, I don't want to put myself or anyone else in their life in danger. And I think, need to go into something like the Missouri River with your eyes wide open.
And that would be, I mean, if you don't mind my saying so, like, if something had happened to you, that would have been awful. It would have been maybe extra awful in the sense that, you know, you'd look back and say, what happened? He got on the Missouri River in a cardboard boat.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds preposterous.
A little bit of absurdity. But, you know, I guess that's, it would also be a story. But, you know, like I did take a lot of precautions, and thanks to people like Vicky and Larry from Healthy Rivers Partnership and my friends Steven and Amanda in the canoe, you know, we were able to basically take all precautions, and they had a lifeline tied to the cardboard boat just in case, you know, the worst were to happen.
You had invited a crowd to come watch this, and the way you were promoting it leading up to the event really emphasized the snacks.
Yeah, Snacks on the River. That was the name of the event. And so my thinking was, you know, ultimately my goal, and I had talked to my wife, Elizabeth, about this the night before, you know, even if the boat fails, if I can get like 50 or so people down to Kaw Point, and for some of them, if it's their first time ever, you know, in that respect, it would be a success. And so at the point, I had plenty of snacks. There was a popcorn machine, drinks, and free boat rides on the Healthy Rivers Partnership boat for whoever wanted to get out on the river. So
you didn't put the other people on the cardboard boat too?
No. There would be no room, and I'm not going to take on that liability for sure. But it was great to see so many people get a chance to get out on the Missouri River, because from my perspective as a rather new transplant to Kansas City, it seems rather unutilized. And part of that is what I love about the river. When you're out there, you're all by yourself. For the most part.
And except for those 50 people you've invited.
Except for then. Yeah. And so now hopefully people walk away with a new appreciation of being on the Missouri River.
But help me understand, like, you get in this cardboard boat on the Missouri River. Where did you start? You started at the Kaw Point?
I pretty much made it, I think, well, we started at Kaw Point Boat Ramp, which is just up from Kaw Point, which is, you know, right at the confluence of the Missouri and Kansas rivers. And we got there early in the morning, tested things out. Pretty much right away, once they cut me loose, I kind of just like floated right into a willow tree and got stuck. So then they towed me up river some ways up to the near where the bridges were, and tied me to their boats. And from there, we were able to make our way down to Kaw Point. So, you know,
Other than the willow tree, any perilous moments?
Well, the willow tree was kind of perilous, because that's where I broke my rudder. I got pinched up in the willow tree next to the Healthy Rivers boat. And, you know, with the current flowing and trying not to get, you know, break their motor or break my boat in their motor, you know, I snapped the rudder. You know, it's just cardboard, so didn't take much to do that. But I'd say that was probably the most perilous moment. But when they finally, you know, did cut me loose to float down to Kaw Point, that was just pretty much a glorious 5 minutes of scrambling and paddling and trying to maneuver my way as best I could to the point where everyone was waiting for me.
Has this changed your relationship to this river, to the confluence of two rivers, I should say?
Well, sure. I'm sure it's changed it in some way. I don't know how, to be honest, other than I felt like it was the realization of a dream. I mean, this is something that I've looked forward to for honestly about 2 years. And I didn't know how it would pan out. I kind of love the poetry that while I did not quite get to realize the dream of going through the riverfront and getting to maneuver and the way that I really wanted it to, I just crossed the line into the Missouri River. You could see that line of mud where the Kansas and the Missouri meets, and my boat went right past that and docked right there at the point. And I just thought that was kind of a beautiful kind of poetic ending to this dream of what I've been going for.
Well, so, and you've mentioned that you call yourself an adventure artist, and it doesn't seem like a concept that's too far afield from stuff other people do, but it seems like it's a term that I haven't heard.
Yeah, I think a lot of people do this kind of stuff. I just kind of created the term to describe this kind of experiential performance-based art practice that basically I just like to create adventures for myself or for other people, and then I like to create art surrounding those experiences. So, you know, whether that's video or painting or a cardboard boat, kind of like using your art practice to create interesting life experiences.
What is different about going on an adventure that you've created, like making your own props and your own rules and your own, I don't know, performance of it in some ways? What is different about that than going on an adventure like, you know, you could go skydiving?
I don't know if there is it. Well, I guess the difference is maybe going into it with a certain idealization or image in mind of how you want that adventure to appear for others and how you want to tell that story, and taking your time to really craft that image. And that's what I've done with Daunting Courage.
Daunting Courage, that's the name of your boat?
That's the name of my boat.
Where's the boat now?
The boat is currently at Healthy Rivers Partnership and then I'm going to pick it up and take it back to my studio for repairs, because I'll be bringing it to a show in Ohio in about a month.
Will you sail it again?
I bet I will. I think it would handle really well on a nice lake or pond.
Well, our time is up. Steve Snell, thanks so much for being here today.
Well, thank you, Gina Kaufman. I appreciate being on your show.
No one ever says my full name back to me. Well, Steve Snell set sail on the Kansas City waterfront this past weekend in a boat he'd spent 2 years making. You can listen back to this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, Kansas City native Nathan Darrow was in House of Cards, and now he's headed back to town for the Shakespeare Festival Hamlet this summer. Nathan Darrow, tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Danielle Hogarty is our intern. I'm Gina Kaufman.